Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. The record price achieved at the sale of Van Gogh's Sunflowers made world headlines. But what of the man who sold the painting? My guest on Meet the Writers today presided over that sale and many more of huge importance by one of the leading auction houses, Christie's. Well, he's now written a highly personal and entertaining account of life at the firm, lifting the lid on the mysterious and moneyed world of art sales. Charles Alsop, Lord Hindlip, welcome to Meet the Writers. Thank you so much for coming in. Now, we're here to talk about your lovely book. It's called An Auctioneer's Lot, Triumphs and Disasters at Christie's. And I wanted us to start right at the beginning. Was your home, your childhood home, filled with art?
No, it absolutely wasn't. There was a picture by a local Northamptonshire artist called Alice Burton of my sister and a small sketch that she did of me. That was about it.
So where did the interest come from?
I think the interest came from when I was very young. My grandfather, who wasn't particularly interested in art, but taught me to draw foxes, which he was extremely keen on hunting. And I think just starting drawing at a young age made me look at things. And then I have to owe quite a lot to my mother, who again, from quite a young age, took me to museums. I remember going to the Wallace Collection when I was quite young. I think he was absolutely wonderful. So I suppose it really started then.
Mm. Did you receive any encouragement at Eton?
No. Eton wasn't great. It had a quite nice drawing school, but there were two masters who taught drawing. The senior one was an extraordinarily nice man called Wilfrid Blunt, who was the brother of Anthony Blunt, who was less nice. But he despaired of teaching Etonians to draw and only really taught people to improve their handwriting. He was an expert on Italic writing, and I did a bit of that with him. And the other master, perfectly nice man, but I think he tried to rush people into doing things which were too modern for my particular taste. So no, I got very little encouragement. Mm. In fact, the thing I remember most about drawing at Eton was not encouragement, but punishment. I've always been interested in buildings, and I finished a history essay and started designing a palace. Perhaps it was unwise to have done it in the book, which I was meant to be writing essays on. And as a punishment, I had to do an exact copy of it 10 times. Which almost put me off architectural drawing for life.
You went on to the Coldstream Guards and from there made the leap to Christie's, and I wonder how that happened.
Oh, that happened because I'd actually tried to get a job in Christie's before I went into the army. I loved the army. I was extremely lucky to be accepted by that perfectly wonderful regiment, and I did it for 3 years and I enjoyed it, but I was never going to be a general. And by this time I got more and more interested in painting. And, yeah, I came to the conclusion that's what I wanted to do as a career.
Mm-hmm. But your interview there was pretty disastrous.
I had several interviews, and they weren't very good. And then I had this final one when I got the job. I didn't know the then chairman of Christie's at all, because he didn't have children himself. He wasn't terribly good at interviewing very young people, but we got on all right, and He'd had a very good day, so he gave me a job on a trial basis, and he wrote a very nice letter to my father, who he did know slightly, saying, "I can hold out little hope for a boy of his age." He really meant he'd had a very little hope for me, but it was a nice letter, and I stayed on for the allotted year, and at the end of the year I went on holiday, and I came back, and I wondered what was going to happen, and I'd resumed my job on the desk in Christie's, and one of the other directors came and I said, "What are you doing there, Charlie? You're meant to be cataloguing pictures." Well, no one had told me that. It was what I'd always wanted to do, but I was just sort of shoved into this basement and given a whole stack of pictures and told to get on and catalog them. It was a rough old world in those days.
One of the first big sales that you were involved with was Northwick Park. Tell us about that.
Ah, yes. Northwick. Well, Northwick belonged to the most charming then, I think, any 89-year-old George Spencer Churchill, who was a cousin of Winston's and had inherited through his mother one third of what had been one of the greatest collections of paintings in the British Isles. And it was still very impressive, and he added to it himself. He was a passionate collector of antiquities. He knew a great deal about Greece, he knew a great deal about Egypt, and he also knew a great deal about Oh Master painting. And he lived in a large house. He never married. I don't think he really liked women very much. It was extraordinarily uncomfortable, quite badly maintained, because in those days, really, people had possessions, but they had very little money. And he had been very badly wounded in the First War. Not once, but twice, he was shot through the head. Both the hats he was wearing at the time were displayed on the hall table with bullet holes in them. It was quite extraordinary he'd survived at all. The only real defect it had left him with was it had removed his sense of smell and taste. So he didn't realise how awful the food was. And he didn't also realise how bad his wine was. But apart from that, staying with him was a joy because he was incredibly good at imparting information and incredibly good at taking you around his pictures and his antiquities and his Egyptian things. He was wonderful, and I used to go and help him take groups around the house. In fact, I was actually staying in the house when he died in rather grisly circumstances in his flat in London. I learned a lot from him. And then when he died, he left in his will that he wanted Christie's to sell the collection, and we had to set about cataloguing it. And there were over 1,000 pictures, ranging from the very good to the quite modest. But the very good were very good indeed.
Mm. One theme that comes up again and again in this very beautifully illustrated book is how much it comes down to personal connection, how much these big sales relied on the fact that people knew somebody at Christie's or you had some knowledge of some fabulous works of art hidden away in some crumbling manor somewhere.
Well, it was partly that, but it was partly the fact that both Christie's and Sotheby's were respectively just over 200 years old and just under 200 years old. And we had clients going back into the 18th century. And people, I think, were loyaler in those days than they are now. And if a family had always dealt with a firm, they tended at least to come back and give you a chance. And Christie's was hit by a bomb in the war, and all the libraries went. But the catalogues were in a fireproof vault. And throughout the whole of the 19th century, Christie's were way ahead of anybody else. So anything that had been bought and sold then, we had a record of. And something which I'm not sure they do, I don't think they do any longer, all pictures were stenciled on the back in indelible ink that was very, very difficult to get off. People used to try and remove it, but you could usually see a sort of ghost of a number on the backs of stretchers, and normally the canvas pictures are on stretchers and they stenciled onto the wood, or if it's a panel, they stenciled straight onto the back of the panel. So we had this, and we were able to look through lists of old clients and see what they had. And yeah, we did used to get in touch with people, but in those days, it was far more, to be honest, they got in touch with us.
Mm. A lot of it, of course, very sad too, the clearances of big houses, quite often after a death.
It was very sad, and in that period in the 60s and 70s, death duties were enormous. Tax on income was enormous. And it wasn't until Mrs. Thatcher's second administration, when Nigel Lawson was the Chancellor, that income tax came down below 80%. And people just don't realise how little money people had or how little money they were able to keep. These houses took a vast amount to keep them up, even to standards that could be lived in. So yeah, there was a constant amount coming on the market. It didn't fetch in those days very huge sums of money. Our turnover the year I joined Christie's was under £3 million. Hmm. I mean, now that's a sort of moderately good Degas drawing.
Yes. Your rise in the firm was pretty rapid. You went off to New York to start the office there and eventually to head it too.
Well, yeah, it was only rapid because there were so few people. We were expanding very, very quickly. And my first year there were only 96 people in Christie's. And that was everything. Directors, specialists, cataloguers, clerks, accountants, porters, 96 of us. So rising through that wasn't too difficult. And if they were, you know, we were bringing people in all the time, but even so, if one was halfway decent, one tended to advance.
And you travelled the world with it, of course.
You
set up the office in New York, as we said, but you were in Australia, you spent a lot of time in Geneva, you were travelling everywhere.
Yeah, because we suddenly started from having just sold in the rooms in King Street. We started selling in New York, we started selling in Geneva, we started selling in Rome, we started selling in Germany, in Holland, in Spain. The one place we were never allowed to sell was France, so we opened an office in Monte Carlo instead because it was almost France and it had tax advantages. But yeah, we sold. At one stage, we had over 80 offices and over 20 sale rooms.
Quite a lot of wild goose chases as well. You'd go off and look at works of art, sometimes find something fabulous, other times not. There was one memorable story when you went to look at mirrors in Ireland by the Booker brothers.
Ah, yeah, they didn't turn out to be the Booker brothers. They turned out to be made by company located not so far from where we're talking, John Lewis.
And you found those labels on the back.
We found the John Lewis labels on the back, yeah. It was a bit of a disappointment.
Now, many of the people that you've dealt with have fascinating backstories. I love what you write about the Duchess of Kingston and her marriages.
Duchess of Kingston, yeah, she was a goer. I'm not absolutely certain whether she was the only peeress to be tried for bigamy, but there weren't many of them, and she got off just, but she did own probably the greatest pair of French 18th century tureens ever to come on the market.
And the pictures of them in the book, they are absolutely stunning.
Oh, yeah, well, the book, yeah, we took a lot of trouble with the printing. It's all done in Italy, and I think it is really rather good.
Because catalogues, I mean, the book makes frequent reference to the catalogues, and how a catalogue is done is supremely important to how an auction house presents itself to the world.
Yes, it is. I'm not sure it hasn't gone slightly too far now. We always took a lot of trouble with our catalogues, but then we were sort of on the cusp of black and white and colour photography. In the first 10 years, really, I worked in Christie's, most of the catalogues were produced in black and white, and you would have a sort of colour frontispiece, or you'd have one or two illustrations in colour, but the majority would be in black and white. There are those, I can't number myself amongst them, who always said it's better to illustrate things in black and white because at least it doesn't give a false impression. Because even now, it's very interesting how different the quality of the colour is in various. If you spend a lot of money on the printing, you can get wonderful colour illustrations. If you don't spend a lot of money, you get colour illustrations, but they often bear no real relationship to the colour of the objects.
What happens in an auction when a high price has been achieved, but then it turns out the buyer can't pay?
Touching wood, which I fortunately have in front of me, it doesn't happen very often. As long as the auction house sticks to its rules, in other words, sticks to the contract and doesn't release the goods to the defaulting buyer, it's not under any liability to the seller until payment takes place. So if it doesn't take place, there is no contract. If one doesn't stick to one's terms of sale, then it can get quite difficult. But in the very small number of cases that I can remember where people didn't perform, and I only had to handle two myself. In one case, we got the seller the full amount. We had to cut our own commission a bit, and the seller had to wait to get the money rather longer than he would have done. On the other case, which was the extraordinary story of the calculator, the poor owner got a lot more than they originally thought they were going to get, but nothing like what it was knocked down for in the sale. And it's still a story which puzzles me, why two people, one of whom had no intention, could in no way have performed on his bid, went as far as he did. But in a way, I can understand that, because poor man, he was suffering from brain tumour and he just effectively went mad. And he'd been a very... I don't think we were in any way to blame for accepting his bids, because we knew him, he was utterly reliable. What we didn't know was he'd suddenly gone, he had this brain tumour. What's always fascinated me was why the underbidder went on to these extraordinary heights. And of course, the underbidder in a sale has no responsibility to perform at all. You cannot go after the underbidder because he didn't buy it.
Mm, mm.
Sometimes, obviously, you can say, well, are you interested? He's, well, at a slightly lower price, he says, I probably am interested. In this case, we never even knew who it was.
Mm. You have some wonderful stories. For instance, there's one about the Cecil Beaton sale where bids were being taken by Lot 14, from Lot 14.
Yes, that was my very, very nice old colleague who had... his eyesight wasn't terribly good, particularly late in the afternoons, and sometimes these sales dragged on a bit. And it was slightly harsh. There was a statue at the back of the tent, a rather good-looking lady with a raised arm. And he looked at this lady with her arm up, and he thought she was actually bidding. He didn't realise for about 8 or 9 bids that it wasn't actually a bidder. It was a lot. But we offered the man who bought it a reduction, but he was so intrigued by the story, and he wasn't a huge amount of money. He said, no, I'll pay up. It's just a rather nice story.
I want to go to 1985, which was memorable because you almost got fired and you became chair of Christie's.
Yeah, that was really difficult. We agreed to take on something for sale, which turned out that the seller had absolutely no rights even to own. It had been exported from Spain, in this case, with some very dubious documentation, and the Spanish government took the seller and ourselves to court and managed to prove to pretty much everybody's satisfaction, that except the sellers, that it should never have left Spain and we should never have accepted it. In one way, it got us out of a very difficult situation, because by this time, the one thing we didn't want to do was to sell this picture, because we were fooled by the documents. We believed to an extent that the seller had a right to sell it. I was always slightly dubious about it, and I asked his lawyers, sort of on oath, so to speak, whether he had the right to sell it, and they said he did. It wasn't true. But it was a very, very difficult situation, and I have to say, and will always say, that the Spaniards behaved absolutely impeccably, and we reached a settlement with them by which they paid the owner a pretty handsome sum of money to retain the picture in Spain. It's still now in the Prado, where it's much admired. Had we sold it, it would have made more, but we were never going to have done so.
Mm. By 1987, you were chairman of the firm, and of course, that's when Sunflowers came to you.
Yeah, that was exciting. I mean, what was it, Andy Warhol said everybody has 15 minutes of fame. That was certainly my 15 minutes of fame. The picture, which I think one has to admit, probably wasn't the best picture Van Gogh ever painted, but it roused huge interest, and it was in March 1987. up till that point, no picture had fetched more than just over £8 million. The Sunflowers was eventually sold for £22.5 million. I mean, in other words, it was 2.5 times, nearly 3 times, what any picture had ever fetched before. And I suppose, although it didn't remain the most expensive picture ever sold for all that long, it created a whole new market at the end of the 1980s, which was one of those periodical step-ups where the value of pictures just multiplies by, yeah, a huge amount overnight. Mm-hmm. And suddenly things that had been worth £1 million were worth £3 million, things that were worth £10 million were worth £30 million. The whole thing just sort of came up because of this one sale. And it caught everybody's imagination.
The book is so rich with fascinating stories, and I'm aware that we're missing out many of them in this interview. We couldn't possibly touch on them all. I want to fast forward a little bit to 1995 and a trip to America, to a house that at that time was very little known by the rest of the world, but now, of course, is very famous because it's owned by Donald Trump.
Oh, Mar-a-Lago. Mar-a-Lago. What a... The great thing about Mar-a-Lago is its position. It's sort of schoolboy Spanish. Mar, sea, lago, lake. The property stretches all the way from the coast across the Palm Beach Peninsula to the lake or the inland waterway. And it used to belong to Mrs. Meriwether Post of cornflake fame. And it was bought from her estate in 95 by, as you rightly say, Donald Trump. And he wanted a valuation of the contents. And I was slightly reluctant to get involved, but in the end I did. And I went down to meet the future president in his new house. And I must admit, he was very straightforward to deal with. Well, it wasn't a big sale. I can't remember exactly how much we did sell, but I remember being fascinated by the house, fascinated by where it sat, and actually also fascinated by Mrs. Meriwether Post than I was at the time. Everybody knew Donald Trump by that time. He'd already built Trump Tower, and he was starting to make a mark. But he hadn't bought any great works of art, and I don't know now who's bought what. I'm sort of out of the loop, but I don't think he's been a great art buyer, but I could be wrong.
Another very big sale of a prominent person's possessions that you did was Princess Diana.
Yes, the dresses, which we did in aid of the Marsden Hospital and the London Lighthouse, which is a very good charity that looks to look after people who've got HIV, which he was extremely keen on supporting. And it was, I have to say, she was absolutely wonderful to do the sale with. She was a born showman. She had a wonderful way with people. The dresses themselves were not, I don't know very much about, my wife was always beautifully dressed, but on a very small budget. I've never really known a great deal about expensive ladies' clothes. And Princess Diana was always also beautifully dressed. I think that really it was more the name than the clothes that brought the punters in. It was not an easy sale to take. It was quite difficult, actually. I struggled a bit.
You eventually left Christie's in 2002. Your last sale was then, in fact. Why leave?
Oh, I was in my 60s by then. I had done 41, nearly 42 years. I think I'd just been there long enough. And I was quite interested in doing something on my own or with a smaller group of people, not in an auction house. I wanted to try my hand as a dealer. I wanted to spend more time painting myself. I just felt that I'd been there, and I think I was right, that I'd reached the end of that particular road, and I want to start on a new road. And I'm not a regretter. I don't look back on things and think, gosh, I wish I'd done that differently, because there's no point. One learns by one's mistakes. But leaving Christie's wasn't a mistake. Christie's has done jolly well since I've left. So I don't have any feelings of guilt towards them, and I haven't done too badly myself. So no, I don't regret leaving.
And of course, now you run Hinlip Fine Art.
Yeah, Hinlip Fine Art is not a great company. It makes a profit, but it's not. I'm not Lord Duveen.
Lord Hinlip, before we go, I just wonder about your take on the future of the art market. As you point out in the book, it's one of the very few, very large markets that's completely unregulated. Where is it heading?
Yeah, I don't think. I often wonder about the regulation of the art market. There probably are some areas which possibly could be more closely regulated than they are, but that's not really the point. I have two feelings. One I've already expressed, I think. I don't like art being used as a vehicle for investment. It doesn't really work. It's too insecure. Tastes change too quickly, and one's seen on a number of occasions trends changing and people just going off whole periods of works of art. You cannot say, as people expect one to do, something what something is going to be worth in 10 years time, 20 years time. You just don't know. And I think the very modern end of the art market is overheated. It's not what I think which is important. It's people like, for instance, Gerhard Richter, the German painter, who said himself he thinks his pictures are overpriced and that people are paying foolish prices for them. I think there is too much of an emphasis on too small a slice of the market. It has changed from being a very broad-based, I mean, just flipping through the pages of my book, so the enormous variety of what we sold in the 70s, 80s and 90s, it's now much more confined. There are no great silver sales, there are far fewer great furniture sales, old master drawing sales, which in 1986 we sold drawings for the Duke of Devonshire Chatsworth. It was the biggest sale of the year. Get accustomed now that getting an old master sale, which did sell more than an impressionist sale. It's this concentration of huge prices paid by a very small group of people for a very particular group of modern paintings, which I think is fragile.
Well, you've certainly given us an absolutely fascinating look at it in your book, An Auctioneer's Lot, Triumph and Disasters at Christie's. Lord Hinlip, thank you so much for coming on to meet the writers.
Not at all. Thank you very much for talking to me.
An Auctioneer's Lot is published by Third Millennium Publishing, and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, presented by me, Georgina Godwin. Many thanks to Claire Urban. You can download this programme and others in the series from our website. And if you'd like to be in touch, it's gg@monocle.com. Thank you for listening.